financial services industry plays a central role in a world and economy that are living through interesting times. With all the upheaval and uncertainties that this brings, governments, central banks, and regulators all look to effective regulation and risk management across the industry to ensure a stable base to drive growth for society and, by implication, for the financial services industry itself. Our podcast series delves into the key trends and challenges for financial services, and in this episode, we take an in-depth look at the current key themes in the insurance sector. So joining me today, please could I welcome to the podcast my co-hosts, Rob Benson and Stuart Riddle. Rob is a partner in the Financial Services Group at Grant Thornton, and Stuart is a director in the Financial Services Group at Grant Thornton. Welcome to both of you.
Hi, Alex. Hi, Stuart.
Hi, Alex. Thank you for having us.
So let's get straight into the detail. In 2023, firms were working really hard to satisfy consumer duty requirements ahead of the July 2023 deadline. Rob, can I come to you first? What are you seeing firms do to make sure that they can evidence the delivery of good customer outcomes under the consumer duty?
Thanks, Alex. I think it's plain to say that it's a hot topic for those organisations where it's at the heart and centre of where their customer base is. So for retail organisations, particularly personal lines insurers, intermediaries and the like, it has very much been their focus on a project basis to get to that important deadline over the course of 2023, and obviously setting up for things like reporting requirements over the course of 2024. So it has continued to be the right thing to do when we speak to our clients, not just to toe the party line with the regulator, but they're now starting to see that actually for reputational purposes, it's had a huge impact for them as well. From a regulatory perspective, there is, of course, a very heavy focus. We're starting to see much more questioning and challenge from regulators around just a demonstrable evidence of what they've done around consumer duty. Have organisations purely focused on making sure that good customer outcomes are being achieved and that there's evidence of doing so? And there's some really interesting case studies around products, particularly product governance life cycles, product assessments, to really focus on asking that difficult question, which is, it might be extremely profitable for us as an organization, but actually, do our consumers need that? And that's where the commerciality needs to come in. And perhaps that's where the regulators are starting to just focus a little bit more laser-like around what that need looks like for the entity. So one of the areas that we've certainly seen from our clients is making sure that they have that demonstrable evidence over the actions that they're taking to make sure that customers very much are at the heart of their decision-making, whether that's in terms of product governance assessments, whether that's in terms of product lifecycle programs, making sure that just because it's commercial for the organization, that it still fits the consumer profile that they want to work with. In terms of regulators themselves, we're certainly expecting greater veracity of their investigations, certainly for those organizations that perhaps don't have the huge armies of people in the compliance, risk and operations functions to implement consumer duty. And as such, I'd imagine some of those will come under greater scrutiny with skilled person activity, potentially fines to come there as well. But organisations have very much, from our perspective, taken it very seriously. They've addressed particularly the diversity of products that they have, seeking to offer customers reasonable alternatives. And that has meant that the product range has increased to make sure that there is affordability in those particular products that will be attractive to consumers, but equally not necessarily throwing all of their products out and starting again. So looking at perhaps enhanced products, looking at a more base level product, just to make sure that it fits the needs of those customers. What we're also seeing is that organisations are looking at consumer duty from a publicity point of view, making sure that they've got a good story to tell. And we're certainly seeing that as part of the most recent report and accounts releases over the course of the December year ends, where organisations are much more focused around the consumer focus that they've had over the course of the last 2 years, particular to consumer duty, and making sure that their consumer base are fully aware as to what that means for them and what they've done.
And Stuart, like any transformation programme, this all becomes about how this gets delivered in BAU now, right?
I think that's right, Alex. And I think what I would add to what Rob has said there is that the organisations that have done this well and where they will continue to succeed are those that will put consumer duty at the heart of an integral to what they're doing, as opposed to thinking of it as a separate thing, if you will. So transformation programs which have everything thought through with a consumer duty lens will go well, have gone well, continue to go well. And indeed, when you're thinking about other aspects of transformation, so for example, customer MI, improving data or have you, having the requirements and the themes of consumer duty imbued in that and not thinking about it as an add-on, has seen organisations succeed. So having this central and imbued in everything that organisations are doing, and if I go into consulting lingo, perhaps as a design principle, will stand organisations in very good stead.
Just to follow on from that, Stuart, it's an excellent point. Where we see this potentially being challenging for organisations are those that they could play in the grey. There was a little bit around interpretation when the consumer duty came in and the feeling that organisations were already adhering to consumer duty. I think this will be a very interesting period over the course of the next 6 to 12 months where playing in the grey will be identified. And the next question will be, well, give us back demonstrable evidence again that you have considered it. And it's not just a theme, an intangible, you're actually living and breathing it.
So as an overlay to all of that, and I think we'll get into some data related aspects a little bit later as well, Stuart, but picking up on one of the themes of the moment, you can't go anywhere in 2024 without talking about artificial intelligence in some way, shape or form, and how firms are going to integrate that into businesses in a way that really delivers value to both the business and to customers. What are you seeing? How can firms continue to make use of artificial intelligence and that type of technology going forwards?
Yeah, no, Alex, I think you're right. It's rare and indeed extraordinary where in a client conversation at the moment, this topic does not crop up. So a few things and a few observations on what we're seeing and where success can be found. I think the first question for insurance entities to think about is, what exactly do you mean by artificial intelligence? Because it is such a wide-ranging term that can pervade a huge array of interactions, a huge array of technologies, and a huge array of solutions. It's almost that long-standing metaphor of you're trying to eat an elephant here, and therefore how do you unpack that and actually make it accessible for your particular organization? So first thoughts and observation would be actually understand what it is that artificial intelligence means to the particular organization that you are. And then in terms of actually how you might do that, it's almost thinking about, do you want this to be something that helps your end customers? So helps them interact with you, helps them understand your services, helps them engage with you at a time or a moment of your choosing? Or, and everything in insurance is linked, right? Is it something that you want to look to use in your back office around untangling the data that you have, the complexity of the processes that you have, trying to make you more joined up across the various products that you have? So organizations that are thinking about this and doing this well, would be my observation, are actually, what is a very clear strategy for our approach to artificial intelligence? And like everything, agreeing where you think it can work for your organization and agreeing where things might not be applicable now, I think is the way to tackle this problem, and is where we're seeing organisations grapple with the elephant, if you will.
And I think that's a case of first mover syndrome as well, isn't it, Stuart, whereby once we see a real activity in the marketplace, others will follow. But I think there's some nervousness around being that first mover, almost to the extent where they don't want that value chain to be disrupted, because again, from an insurance perspective, we are quite traditional, we are quite archetypal, and there is the innovation question mark. So from our perspective, we've certainly seen use of AI and tech at an underwriting level, particularly around algorithmic underwriting in the P&C market. We've seen it in the personal lines market to monitor and respond to rate movements, which has been very helpful with certainly the GIP, or General Insurance Pricing Practices rules, that came in around about 18 months ago. So we've started to see snippets of it. I feel that there'll be continued investment, but just that hesitancy to deploy, much to Stuart's point, which is, do we want something that's going to be shiny out there and makes us very attractive to the consumer? Or do we want something that's going to sit in the background that makes us more efficient and more optimal? But as a wrapper to both of those would be around, well, what's the regulation going to be in terms of use of AI and insurtech? Because we are known to be quite cautious as a sector. Having new technologies only means that there will be some form of new regulation around that. And what we're hearing, certainly from the regulator, is we shouldn't be making key decisions purely based on AI and insurtech. It should be fully understood what the tools are that we currently have to arrive at the data that we can then use for those decision making. So for me, it's very much a case of that regulation is going to be coming a little after the event, but it's going to be a case of, well, you need to understand what the black box is actually doing to make sure that the black box isn't failing. So regulation in this particular area is going to be a very hot topic in, well, years to come, quite frankly.
And I think, Rob, I guess my final comment on that would be, I think it's understanding what you're going to do about this is linked more broadly into what's your organisational strategy and what are you comfortable doing. So for some organisations, being a fast and nimble follower here might be the right answer. For other organisations, they might want to be ahead of the curve and perhaps look to grow market share or cut costs more quickly by being at the head of the queue here. And therefore, where you go on this probably links as to where you want to be on that strategic spectrum.
Thank you both. And from one really big subject to another, really, climate and sustainability clearly feature globally on pretty much every agenda that's out there at the moment. I'm really interested just to get your perspectives as to what the insurance market is doing, particularly in relation to sustainability. And Rob, do you want to answer that first, maybe?
Yeah, happy to. I guess this is such a broad ranging subject that it impacts the sector, as I'm sure it does with many other sectors, in many different ways. But if we look at the fundamental purpose of insurance, especially in the P&C market, it's about dealing with catastrophes. It's about dealing with the challenges in terms of windstorms, hurricanes, earthquakes, amongst many, many other natural catastrophes. And obviously sustainability is very much linked to climate change, and climate change very much an indicator of seeing a very different climate and the ease of forecasting climate events. It will become more and more challenging as a result. So for me, sustainability is fundamental to the purpose of what we do in the insurance market. I think from a sector's point of view, we need to very much focus around resilience, going through our journey on sustainability, making sure that there are the reserves in situ across the market that allows us to grow and ensure that we can deal with those challenges and claims when they arise as a result of climate-related risks. That's going to be, well, continues to be, a focus on many organisations. And again, linking to insurtech and AI, I very much expect to see how organisations can better deal with climate-related risk through technology. So resilience is going to be critical. We need to make sure that the market's supportive of each other as much as it's a competitive market, to make sure that actually the end result here is that we can serve the individuals within the marketplace, our end consumers, be that either commercial or retail. Of course, we've got much more that we can do as an organisation to better protect the environment. As a sector, do we need to think about what we do with high-risk, environmentally destructive and carbon-intensive sectors? Do we go down an avenue where we look at those where we could be denying cover for those particular activities? Obviously, that then goes against the ingrained provision of service to all sectors, but we've got to think about how that can be done much better. Equally, do we phase out risks covering fossil fuel-related activities? Again, we're starting to see organisations very much focusing on their green headlines and making key decisions around that, even if it is to a commercial detriment of the organisation. So I think there's going to be a continuation of need to focus on sustainability, but I do think that needs to be much more of a collective market effort as opposed to the individual entities within the market. We are seeing some fantastic initiatives out there. We're seeing some great headline-grabbing initiatives. But as a collective, that needs to be delivered on the whole as opposed to individual organisations.
And I think the one thing I would add to that, Rob, would be if we think about climate change, sustainability, and indeed AI that we've just covered, insurers and all participants in the insurance ecosystem, like all other organisations, are to some extent in a war for talent at the moment. And those individuals that have the skill set around climate change, those individuals that have the skill set around AI are able to make some very specific choices around the organisation that they work for and with. And therefore, organisations in the insurance world thinking about how they themselves are reflecting these challenges, how they're reflecting, for example, access for staff to electric cars, those kind of things, will perhaps better place themselves to access the scarce talent pool that will drive further success on this topic in AI, in data, and all those other things that insurers are grappling with at the moment.
Thanks, Stuart. And this does seem like a good time to delve a little more into that data point in a bit more detail. We've touched on it earlier when we were talking about artificial intelligence. There's clearly an element where data is going to be really important in supporting firms demonstrate what they are and are not doing around sustainability. And it's clear that, like much of the world, insurance is right in the middle of being a hugely data-driven ecosystem. From your perspective, how can firms ensure that they're getting the most out of their data?
I think that's a really interesting question, Alex. And I think my starting point for this is that insurers should to some extent be advantaged in this regard, because we have these wonderful people called actuaries who are to some extent the original data scientists. And there's me paying a compliment to an actuary, so that they'll all be surprised and delighted by that. But I think through 200-300 years of history, the art of insurance has all been about leveraging and using one's data to best effect and to the ends of the customer, whether they be individuals, corporates, brokers, or what have you. So I think that gives the organisation a certain cultural background as to what it's looking to achieve here. And then I think once you get on from that, you actually have to then think about the individual challenges that the organisation faces. So for example, if I look at some of the very well established large insurance entities that we work with, they have huge customer reach, huge products, huge capabilities, but are probably encumbered by some legacy products and systems. If you're in that position, the advances in data, what data scientists can now do in terms of releasing the power of that data, delivering more services to customers, actually bringing some efficiency into the organization, linking into consumer duty, enabling AI, all of that is absolutely key. And then I think the other piece that I would come to is how can you actually leverage this capability and these advances at the moment of truth for customers? So where we see organizations doing some really good and powerful things is how can you leverage data to actually make services for a customer at the moment of making a claim quicker, more intuitive, more rapid, and get the help to that customer when they need it. So I think thinking about the particular challenges of your organization, do you have legacy challenges to overcome? Are there challenges with your processes in meeting the needs of customers? Or generally, can you help customers access your services at a time and moment of their choosing? I think that's where data can make a really big difference in and around insurance. So, Rob, that's my perspective.
Thank you, Stuart. Well, you'd be pleased to know that I absolutely agree. I think we have witnessed some transformative changes driven by data trends over recent years, and we'll continue to do so when we better understand the data we've got and the tools that are available to us. And it is and has shaped how insurers understand risk, how they can customize offerings, how they've engaged with customers, as you rightly say, and then ultimately streamline their own internal operations. So I think we're definitely on that firm data journey, and there'll be different stages within that journey that all organizations will find themselves on. I think organizations, certainly from a risk perspective, would need to ensure that the data that they're using is really a true reality of their business, to allow it then to provide what would then be a reliable basis for prediction models. And you touched on the actuaries. That's another bow to the actuarial community there. Absolutely, we need to be better at understanding what those forecasts will look like, but we can only do that generally on the data that we hold. And this is teaching grandma to suck eggs, I know. But from a risk perspective, and that's effectively the job that I do. It's very much around understanding then that we've got data quality and data governance in sharp focus. You touched on the data challenges arising from legacy systems. In addition to that, you'd have acquisitions, you'll have product diversification that we spoke about. Our product book is not getting any smaller by the looks of it, and as such, data is only going to get greater and greater. So robust data quality and governance frameworks do need that consistent application in order for the data lifecycle journey to be successful. I just add two more. In terms of another trend we are seeing, particularly in the retail side, that personalization of insurance offerings, only because we're allowed to predict the future claims more accurately and we're able to identify those potential risk factors better. So we've definitely seen more advancement there. We're certainly seeing that shift towards personalization for the increase of volume of data sets and enhanced data analytical capabilities in the market, back to that war for talent. So we've seen a movement in that direction. And then the final one is around the ecosystems and partnerships that Stuart mentioned. From a market perspective, we're already sharing data. We're already sharing data via various systems and processes. And I can only anticipate that we would likely need to share data even more so as part of the value chain. And a key challenge there, again, from a risk perspective, will be, well, how do we establish clear standards and agreements on data sharing, data ownership and data usage when we've got so many third parties at play? And if you think about exactly the point Stuart made, which is we have a volume of data, but how do we share that? How do we control that? How do we make the best use of that data? So transparency around data governance aligned with good, clear data strategies will allow for that to happen. But I think I'm probably getting a bit more utopian in my view, like at the moment. Hopefully we'll see that in years to come as opposed to decades to come.
Thanks, Rob and Stuart, on that. I think from my perspective, it's really interesting to see that that's definitely what's in the mind of governments and regulators in a way that ought to make supervising a sector much more effective. But I agree, I think we've got some way to go before we get there. So one of the points that we talked about there, and I suppose particularly when you look at distribution channels and distribution models, lots going on still in and around mergers, acquisitions, and some interesting impacts on distribution chains there. Stuart, what are we seeing around mergers and acquisitions? How much activity is there? What's important for the firms that's involved in that at the moment?
So I think, Alex, 2024 at the moment looks a bit different from 2023. So as we sit here today, and if we look at 2024 thus far, the amount of what you might call large players in the insurance industry making some relatively fundamental choices and engaging in some relatively significant deal making, as we look in across the first quarter of the year, that feels and looks a bit different from 2023. Which I guess is an indication of pent-up demand. It is to some extent an indication of some changes at the top of some of those organisations, and is to some extent a reflection on some organisations doubling down on participation challenges of parts of the insurance value chain and product areas that they want to participate in. And they want to focus on those and exiting areas that they think others are best delivering value for customers in. So it feels different. And then I think the other observation I would have is there are some relatively significant, verging on the aggressive, one might say, commitments being made around those deals to the market. And so if you look at all of the things that we've discussed around consumer duty, all of the things that we've talked about in terms of climate change, having a laser execution on the focus of those deals alongside the origination feels like it's going to be important in 24 and 25, because there seems to be more deal making going on. And I think investors will be looking for certainty around execution of that, given all the other things that insurers and participants in that ecosystem have in their place. And I guess that comes back to governance, control and management of risks and so on and so forth. So in summary, Alex, it feels a little bit more lively than 2023, with the upsides and downsides that presents.
Is that how you see it as well, Rob?
It is, Alex, yeah. I think from our perspective, there's definitely activity where we've got private equity involvement that are looking for some form of exit, be that in the form of another debt deal or equally in terms of an IPO. So many organisations that we're working with are dealing with those conundrums in terms of when is the best time? Are we fit and ready for a virtual data room? What does that look like in terms of multipliers? Because again, multipliers fluctuate depending on results. The results for 2023, based on what we've seen, have been largely positive. So I'd imagine many organisations are now feeling that they're in a position of strength with regards to what that multiple could actually look like. But alongside that is then just the need to be ready, operationally ready for a deal like this. So making sure that operations, systems and processes are fit for purpose, that there are governance, risk and control frameworks that have been robustly tested. Back to my favourite two words, demonstrable evidence of all of this. So how can that be represented as part of the transaction process? And it's not for many of those that have participated will absolutely know, it is not an easy job to do. It takes time, it can be a distraction. And obviously we haven't seen anything around Q1 results yet, but at the moment we anticipate those to continue to go from strength to strength. So very much around the case of making sure the business is ready, spending enough time on deals like this to get the best possible outcome. That's what we're seeing at the moment.
Thanks, Rob. Really interesting. And as we draw the podcast to a close, it's clearly another interesting year. We live in interesting times. We see continued pressure on cost of living. So economic impacts of everything that we've talked about this morning is definitely front and centre for insurance firms to deal with. And that doesn't even get into the fact that at a global level, politics and broader economics this year look for some interesting developments and the degree of uncertainty. So what is it that we see as the main impact on insurers as we navigate the current economic situation at a global level? And Stuart, perhaps I'll come to you first on that.
Yeah, sure. So Alex, I think there's probably two themes or two observations that I would settle on. So I think if we look across the last 2 years, thinking about cost of living impacts and insurance and how that interplays into end consumers, I think it's forced or led consumers to actually try to understand the end value that they are getting from insurance contracts. And if I apply a personal lines perspective to that in general insurance, end consumers trying to unpick the value that they might get for example, a home insurance product and all the technicalities and subdivisions of that contract, has something that our work and talking around the industry is something that as an industry we could help consumers with more. And it comes back, therefore, to the consumer duty piece of actually helping customers understand what they're getting. So in summary, I think that the cost of living and economic pressures have led end consumers to look at insurance contracts and I guess comment on, I'm not sure this is terribly clear. I'm not sure if I can unpick the value here. If I go to Tesco and buy some Brussels sprouts, I understand what I'm getting there. I'm not so sure I understand what I'm getting from this product. So therefore, organisations that are thinking about and have helped consumers unpick what they're getting and perhaps think about, here's a basic product, that's what you get for that. And then if you put on these additional features, that's what you get. Trying to unpick that complexity, I think organisations that have done that, I think have helped themselves during this period, and I think there are lessons there for other participants. So that would be comment number one. And then comment number two has been or would be around insurers recognizing they're part of a broader ecosystem and accepting that there are cost challenges and economic headwinds. How do they treat suppliers, third parties, and so on, that they work with and who are important to the sector going forward and indeed are integral to it? How do you have the appropriate strategy and communications with those organisations that recognises we all have cost challenges, but equally we're in strategic partnerships here that we want to help last for 5-10 years. And those, again, where there have been open, appropriate conversations to that end, I think those have been helpful and positioned organisations for success. So those are my two high-level comments. Rob, what would you like to add?
No, I think you're absolutely along the right lines in terms of my train of thought, in terms of the impact on the consumer. So again, back onto the personal lines market, what have we seen? That continued diversity of product range, I think, is really important, and I'd expect to see more of that potentially. And then you're getting into the affordability aspects of products. So things like premium finance, but attracts quite a significant APR percentage, will come under scrutiny more and more. And I'd certainly expect to see some potential skilled person work in that particular space as to how it's been sold. And back to the question mark around vulnerability. So affordability and vulnerability would need to be questioned even more so on products, where we have to ask the question, is there value in it? And what would happen if we didn't provide that to our consumers? What would the alternatives be? So I think it's a broader mindset around what the consequences and implications would be around products. Value assessments, absolutely. I think you've got to bang on, Stuart, from a personal lines perspective. It's around, well, what do we do in terms of, take motor insurance, our repairers? And what's our current situation with regards to the availability of parts? What's the current position with regards to the availability of resources in the supply chain? Are our suppliers struggling to meet demand? And what's the consequence of that? And is there resiliency in that particular supply chain? And then you're looking at more the value assessments of the commercial world, where we've got MGAs, we've got reinsurers, we've got agents, there are fees that I dare say will be questioned, you know, as part of that value chain. Has each individual organization actually earned that fee, that commission? And what does that look like for the end consumer? So I think there's a lot to ponder there. Certainly buying behavior on non-mandatory insurances continues to be something that we're starting to see a theme on. So back to Stuart, your comment around home insurance, or do I need it? Well, clearly you should, because you need, certainly for buildings insurance, your mortgage purposes, if you need a mortgage. But for those insurances that just aren't completely necessary, are we looking at those and saying, or are the public looking at those and saying, I can do something about that? I mean, in the corporate world, we're certainly seeing more questions being asked around the captive environment. What does that look like for an organisation of our own size? Do we consider self-insurance as opposed to going to the wider market? So there's lots there. And we can't look past fraud as well, certainly in terms of the personal lines market, where coming to a close on a particular contract that's up for renewal, you're looking to say, well, how do I maximise use of what I've just purchased if I haven't had a claim? Do I really want to make a claim? And fraudulent behaviour and that behaviour of consumers will be called into question more so. And then it comes back to the importance of how organisations operationally are structured, particularly around complaints handling, making sure that we are able to deal with complaints from consumers in the right way that offers sympathy, offers empathy, considers the affordability and the vulnerability questions, but also goes back to the beginning and says, well, did we actually sell that with good intent? Did we ensure that the consumer fully appreciated what they were getting? And finding that balance is incredibly difficult, but certainly having a complaints operation that can deal with that swiftly, and as I say, certainly in a more considerate way with the consumer, is what I dare say the public are looking for.
Thank you, Rob, and thank you, Stuart. Some really fascinating insights there into a really wide range of subjects that are clearly going to keep the insurance sector pretty busy throughout 2024. And I think my overriding observation from all of that is that more so than ever in this environment, just how clear it is that the real value that the insurance sector plays in managing risk in these uncertain times as well. So thank you to both of you for sharing those views. It's been great to hear that. And thank you to our listeners for listening to Risk and Regulation Unraveled with me, Alex Ellerton, and our special guests, Rob Benson and Stuart Riddle. We hoped you enjoyed the deep dive into the current sector trends in the insurance world. And if you did enjoy this episode and you want to stay up to date with future episodes, please do subscribe to our podcast via all of the normal places that you find your podcasts. And then that way you'll make sure that you never miss an episode and you'll be the first to know when we release any new content. So on that note, from Stuart, from Rob and from me, goodbye.